Good afternoon. My name is Rita Schulte, and I'm setting in for Celeste Quinn. In this segment of the Afternoon Magazine, we're going to think about 800-pound gorillas, 5.5 billion TV viewers, and other bad statistics. Numbers impact how we form our opinions and make judgments. How often, though, do we think critically about them? My guest today is Carl Bialik. He is a freelance writer living in Brooklyn, New York, a former technology reporter for the online Wall Street Journal, and co-author of The Daily Fix, sports column appearing weekday mornings on WSJ.com. He also writes and edits for the online GelfMagazine.com. What has engaged me for the past few months, though, is his weekly online journal column called The Numbers Guy. Carl has a degree in mathematics and physics from Yale University, and he's long had an interest in looking at the way numbers are used and abused in the news, in business, and in politics. Welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, Carl.
Thank you, Rita.
So how is it that good numbers go bad?
There are many different ways. Sometimes there's a willful party that wants to see a number used to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
More often, I think what happens is that numbers just get repeated, and each time they're repeated, a little bit of the context goes away. The reference to it gets a little bit briefer, a little less of the uncertainty or the mitigating factors get repeated until the number itself takes on a life of its own. And that inevitably leads to misunderstandings or incomplete understanding.
You wrote a column for The Numbers Guy a few weeks ago about how some numbers really ought to be retired. And one of the numbers that I picked out of that we hear it all the time is this 800-pound gorilla. How did the gorilla get that big? Was it just a metaphor that grabbed people's attention?
Yeah, I think it's become a very quick shorthand to say, to refer to some large, powerful object or being or company or agency.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really become a cliche that's not really informing people when it's used, especially because once something becomes a cliche, in order to really express emphasis about the size of something, you need to make a bigger gorilla. So I've had instances of 1,000-pound gorillas, 2,000-pound gorillas, and then even, you know, billion or trillion-pound gorillas, and eventually the term really outlives its usefulness.
Yeah, I guess. So what gave you the idea to start the Numbers Guy column?
Well, I wish I could say it was my idea, but I have to give credit to Bill Gruskin, who's the editor of WSJ.com. He had been just as an editor for a long time and an avid consumer of the news, always aware of these numbers and often aware that numbers that were being repeated weren't quite right, but there wasn't really a forum in which to write about this. You can't so much write regular news articles about this, or at least that's not how most news articles work.
Mm-hmm.
Usually if a news reporter would find that a number wasn't right, he or she just wouldn't use it, but that wouldn't necessarily directly address the problem with the number and the misunderstanding it might be creating. So he had the idea to try the column, and I had similarly been interested in numbers and had written for some of the technology articles that I had done that had written about some numbers in the industry and issues with them, and so it just seemed like a natural thing to try, and I think it's worked out pretty well so far.
Well, it certainly has been an engaging column to read online, I have to say that. And I know I would highly recommend it for Wall Street Journal users, users of the online, to look for that article as it comes out weekly, because you have an interesting approach to your level of skepticism and how people should actually look at this. And how do you, when somebody pops a number out there, what is it about them, what is it about a particular statistic that just says, wait a minute, this can't be right?
Well, that's a good question, and a big part of the column is, you know, what I'm doing is not special. It's not something that I have some special ability to do. I think anybody who dug into these numbers could find similar things. And so what the column is trying to convey is how to spot these numbers and how to know which ones to dig into, because no consumer of the news can possibly investigate all of them. So a few of the hallmarks, one is to look at who's behind the number. And in some cases, especially when a number's been repeated so many times that it's become gospel, there won't be any source attributed, and that's a reason to be suspicious. And the wonders of Google and other databases can often let you find what that original source is, and sometimes it's very old or dubious, or you'll find that there are different numbers from different sources, and for some reason this one is the one that conquered all others. So that's one thing to look for, is the source. If there is a source attributed, is it a respected research institution? Is it a company or an industry group that may have some interest? Is it a respected research institution that got funding from a group that may have had an interest in a number coming out one way or another? Is it somebody who may not have a bias either way, but just isn't really an expert and may not have done all the due diligence before citing the number? One thing that I found happens a lot is you'll see a politician or an industry leader or some public figure cite a number in a speech or in an interview, and because that person has cited the number, it will be quoted frequently and now given lent authority from that person. But that person almost never measured the number his or herself, but got it from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always try to trace it to the source. And then the last thing is some numbers just don't seem to make sense. You look at it and it doesn't really seem right. Like when there was the claim that 5.5 billion people were going to watch the Live Aid concerts on TV. If you have some general sense that that's around the number of people in the world, it would seem unlikely that every single person in the world was going to watch the concerts. So that can often be a good clue to start digging further.
Yeah, I can sort of imagine 5.5 billion television sets, if they could even exist out there.
Right.
And I would imagine that, you know, in the main, if I was reading something and I saw an exaggerated number like that, my head should go, maybe not so much. But there was a number that you mentioned in one column about the number of pornographic websites focusing on children that was, it was still a significant figure. It was 100,000, I think it was, if I'm remembering correctly. And you traced that one back to a website that had disappeared, had Canadian roots, Canadian study.
That was one of those that kind of wound its way through many different sources.
Mm-hmm.
So it was most recently cited to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But then they were in turn citing publications that had, including one of them that had ceased publication and then restarted under different management, which just gives a sense of how long ago it had been. And then that publication was citing the U.S. Customs Service, and that agency has since then reorganized and isn't really called that anymore, and they couldn't trace the original source. So all this went back to some unclear original methodology, and it went back something like 5 or 6 years ago, and the Internet's been a popular part of our lives for maybe twice that time.
Mm-hmm.
So any number about the Internet from, you know, half of its age is not going to be very applicable today.
Okay.
But that was an interesting one, too, because then I pointed out sometimes you'll see a number cited because that's the number that's available, but it doesn't really shed any light on the problem. It doesn't matter how many websites there are that have child pornography. It matters how many people go to them or
mm-hmm.
how many children are shown on them. Those would be more significant numbers, but they're harder to find.
Right, which leads me to a comment that you had made in your July 21st column about selecting a number that's meaningful, that a lot of times there's measurements out there, but they aren't really all that meaningful to things. They're not telling us anything.
Yeah, there's a joke that's repeated in some of the other writings I've been done about this issue of numbers, and it's about a drunk guy looking for his wallet in the street, and he's looking underneath a lamppost, and somebody asks him, "Is that where you remember last having it, or is that where you think you lost?" And he said, "No, I think I lost it over there, but it's dark over there. I can't see anything
yeah.
over there, so I'm looking here."
This is where the light is, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really not, this isn't something that I would suggest. If a reporter really needs to know a certain number or really wants to know a certain number to prove a point or a trend, and that number doesn't exist, I'm not suggesting trying to create that number because journalists are not researchers and
mm-hmm.
I mean, they can certainly do good jobs, but it's really going to be difficult to be able to match what a year-long research study at a university could do.
Mm-hmm.
But I would just argue for not citing any number. It's better to have fewer numbers in a story than to have numbers that are irrelevant or old or misleading.
Right. I know one of the things that I had noticed, a lot of times people are very impressed when there is a number in something, you know, and you hear people talk, well, 20% of the people I know, and you know, did you really count them? You know, and you wonder just how valid some of the numbers we pass around routinely actually are. Is it just because it's expensive or complicated that some of these research studies aren't updated so that we've got some decent information?
That's definitely one reason. Sometimes the study found what it needed to find. If it was an independent research study, you know, the scientist really did want to find the best number, and I believe that. But in other cases, if it's like a sponsored study and it found what needed to be found, there isn't much use to the industry group or advocacy group that sponsored the study to fund it again, because they can just continue to cite that number. And then, you know, for researchers, there is something to be said for their prestige, and, you know, they want to pursue studies that will get them the most notice and the most research grants. So if something has already been done, even if it is valuable to know, get an updated number, it's less valuable than when the number never existed in the first place.
We make a lot of decisions based on some of these studies. I was reading your column about hurricane prediction, which is particularly meaningful this year, about how, you know, sort of a plus or minus, and I know we have a pretty extensive meteorology department here that connects to the university and broadcasts some weather warnings. We're in the tornado belt. We've got a significant storm issue ourselves, but it's a little bit different. And it is amazing that one of the people down in Houston had said that if they guess the numbers wrong, they won't be able to get people to leave again. They won't trust them. So we make some pretty life and death decisions based on some of these things.
Absolutely, and that's a common theme of the column, and a theme about numbers is that use less of them, use them judiciously, and people won't lose trust in them, but use them all the time and use ones that are misleading or old or otherwise flawed, and people will, it can breed too much skepticism to the point where people, it's the boy who cried wolf phenomenon.
Right.
People will no longer trust the numbers that should be trusted.
Yeah, quickly, before I go into a slightly different subject, I wanted to tell our listeners that if you have a bad statistic and you'd like to blow its cover, you can write Carl at numbersguy@wsj.com, and we will be putting that web address on our website when this interview goes up. Something, you know, that I did see, I did a web search on you, and you were talking about web searches at one point, so I thought, well, let's see just what else is out there about this guy. And I noticed in Gelf magazine you did a wonderful column on blurbs for movies. And I thought that was so much fun, about how people just torque things that are written to put it in a movie ad to get people to go to a movie.
Yeah, I actually do that. Well, I try to do it every week. Sometimes I miss it, but it's called the blurbs or blurb racket, and the idea is I go through all the movie ads, and if they say Roger Ebert said something about the movie, I'll go back and check the original review. I'll do that for books and TV shows and theater in New York as well. And I don't include the ones where they quoted it right, because that's less interesting. And there certainly are some where they are quoted correctly. But there are a lot of cases where you can turn a bad review into a really sweet-sounding blurb. Mm-hmm. It's an impressive art, but one that I think it should be exposed so that hopefully it will go away from that advertising practice.
How often are they ever on the money? Is anybody ever quoted correctly? Is everybody sort of kludged a little bit?
Well, there's some movies that are so well reviewed that they don't need to. They don't really need to tweak the quotes. In fact, I found some cases where, especially New York Times, New Yorker, some publications, I think they're critics, both because they're trying to write in a more kind of a more elevated style, and also because I think they're trying to fight this practice and trying not to get blurbed too much, because they don't want to be promotional even if they like the movie. They'll write in a complex way even if they absolutely adore the movie. And so sometimes the advertisers quote like not the most compelling part of the ad simply because of the review in the ad, just because that would make for a more compelling, it's a shorter soundbite, even though it's not quite as praising of the movie. But an interesting case is when there's a book written by an author who's just really esteemed, and yet the book is a dud. And this came up last week. I was looking at the reviews for Tom Wolfe's latest book, and so every reviewer had to give the obligatory comment of Tom Wolfe is a great stylist, has done all these great things in his career, and then went on to say, but this book stinks. And so the ad was quoting from the part of the reviews that were given, putting in the obligatory complimentary thing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just interesting. In some of the articles that I found that you had written online, it's just like you're a truth teller out there trying to find out where the scam is. Gotta love that.
I definitely, that is something that I enjoy doing, is trying to look behind things that are maybe kind of let go often. And try to dig a little deeper, and hopefully that will make readers more skeptical too.
Well, I think that's a great service. I don't think we're nearly skeptical enough about what we take in, either through media or whether we read.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a great service you're doing out there. I have to appreciate it, and I'm looking forward to when you take on annual reports.
Well, I think my colleagues at the Print Journal do a pretty good job.
Yes, they do. They do a fine job. And I have to commend the Journal for a paper. I often thought, after reading your column, if they shook out all of the numbers in the Wall Street Journal, that it would be a one sheet, because this is a really
right.
They really, and so I think that's I'm assuming that you most people feel that they do a fairly good job of vetting their numbers, but I still think it was very brave of them to be the forerunner of a column that goes, let's debunk some numbers here and see if there's any truth behind them.
I'm biased, of course, but I think the Journal is better than most at doing that. But there are cases where I find a number that was repeated in lots of places, and one of the places was the Journal, and we always mention that when that happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciated having the opportunity to meet with you on the air here and talk to you a little bit. I wish you well in your career. I hope to see more columns coming through my desktop with your byline on it, because I really enjoy the numbers guy. And I encourage our listeners, if they can go over to WSJ.com, you'll find The Numbers Guy by Carl Bialik. And thank you very much. We really appreciate talking to you this afternoon.
Thanks to you. I enjoyed it.
Great. Bye-bye.